Dr. Gerald Horn, the prolific professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, has another book out. It's titled The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean.
What's striking about today's United States, among other things, is that the term settler colonialism is not even part of the leftist vocabulary in this country, which is quite shocking, not even in terms of their examination of history, but even more than that, in terms of trying to comprehend the fiasco that we are facing with the November 2016 presidential election. There was rarely an attempt to look at the origins of settler colonialism in North America as a direct product of class collaboration between and amongst poor and richer Europeans, which obviously it was. And with this vaunted bourgeois democracy and then vaunted enlightenment, basically not necessarily coming full-blown from the rich imaginations of hiding the powdered wigs, hiding the brains of these European men, but actually a direct response to material conditions on the ground. The fact the folks from Europe found themselves in a war zone that they were trying to defeat rambunctious indigenous populations, trying to enslave rebellious Africans, and in order to do so, concessions had to be made across class lines to poor Europeans in particular. And like Colin Kaepernick, the now famed, defrocked San Francisco 49ers quarterback, my attention has been drawn to Bacon's Rebellion in 1676 in colonial Virginia, which not only was a turning point in terms of settler colonialism, but in some ways fixed the paradigm for what was to follow for the next 340 plus years, and certainly fixed the paradigm for what was to ensue 100 years later in 1776. That Nathaniel Bacon, a man of means, led a revolt of poor Europeans, and I'm afraid to say some terribly misguided Africans too, against the colonial regime because they thought that the regime was not moving rapidly enough to take the land away from the Native Americans and disperse it to them. And if you understand Bacon's Rebellion, as it has been called, and likewise, if you understand how that rebellion has been misinterpreted by generations of so-called left-wing historians who are always quick to salute these kinds of rebellions without looking at what the ultimate aim is, which is like saluting the rebellion that supposedly took place at the ballot box in November 2016 without looking at what the ultimate result was. If you understand that kind of phenomenon, you'll be able to understand better what's going on in the contemporary United States of America. And once you come to that realization, I'm afraid that you'll come to the similar realization that it's actually worse than it looks.
Yes, leftists herald or hail Bacon's Rebellion as a glimpse of the potential for black-white worker unity, but you see it as a missed opportunity for solidarity between blacks and Native Americans, the two groups that were being crushed by the settlers.
Well, absolutely. And the crushing of Black Native American resistance has been a central theme of settler colonialism. That is to say that another episode that sheds light on contemporary events in the United States of America is the effort by the U.S. government of what had been Spanish Florida circa 1820, and how that led to some of the most serious wars that the United States government was involved in. I'm speaking of the wars of the people we refer to as the Seminoles, who fundamentally had merged with the African population, an African population that was largely Angolan, by the way, and how they fought in 1819, just prior to the U.S. takeover. They fought again in the 1830s, and they fought again in the 1850s. And so there was decades of conflict between Native Americans and Africans on the one side and the U.S. government on the other before the former was defeated. And then, as so often happened, were deported en masse. Northern Mexico, where their descendants continued to reside. One of the points I make in this book, Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, is the nature of ethnic cleansing in North America, which not only involved mass murder, it also involved mass enslavement of the indigenous population, who in some ways were deported en masse. You can find today Native American DNA all over the world because they were sent to the slave markets of Turkey. They were sent to Madagascar. They were sent all over the world. And this was not only a way to make money, it was a way to cleanse the land of their presence and thereby replace them with European settlers. And somehow this obscene and horrid process has been characterized even by some who consider themselves to be radical, believe it or not, as a step forward for humanity. I'm laughing, but it's bitter, sardonic laughter, because if you can take that position, if you can rationalize ethnic cleansing, genocide, mass enslavement, you can rationalize anything. You can rationalize the election of Donald J. Trump.
Yes. It's been estimated that with the European assault and conquest of the New World, 1/5 of the world's population, the Native Americans, were wiped out.
And that may be a conservative estimate if you look at the precipitous drop in their numbers. And once again, 1676 was a turning point in terms of settler colonialism, because not only did you have Bacon's Rebellion in what is now Virginia, which led to the acceleration of the construction of the identity politics of whiteness. And by the way, once again, it's so curious that this dismissive term, identity politics, is rarely, if ever, applied by those on the left to the construction of whiteness, which, of course, was the original toxic version of identity politics. But in 1676, you also had King Philip's War in New England, which was part of this ongoing effort to wipe out the Native American population, cleanse them from that territory, and then sell them into slavery in the Caribbean, into the slave markets of Ottoman Turkey, etc. But then in Barbados, you had a major uprising of Africans as well. And so looking from London in 1676, they saw these three major rebellions. And it was very difficult from their point of view to conciliate or somehow compromise with the Africans in Barbados or the indigenous population in New England. And so the least bad option was compromising with the settlers in Virginia, accelerating the process of cleansing the indigenous population from the land of Virginia, dispersing that land to poor European settlers, heightening the construction of whiteness, thereby lessening the contradictions between and amongst not only Protestants and Catholics, which had been the animating factor of settler colonialism for most of the 17th century, but also seeking conciliation with a Jewish settler community as well. And that became the theme that led to 1776 and the creation of the first apartheid state, the United States of America, which, despite denials to the contrary, even by some of our friends on the left, was doling out rights and privileges on the basis of melanin deficiency not least in the first immigration law of 1790, and is also reflected in the continuing movement west to take the land of the Native Americans, cleanse them from that land, and then stock that land with enslaved Africans, because, as we know, after 1776, the new nation, the apartheid state, the United States of America, replaced London as the captain of the international slave trade, and then leveraged that position in North America to take over control of international slave trade to Cuba by the 1790s, and to Brazil, the biggest market of all, by the 1840s. Not only that, they were then assisted by their comrades in the so-called Lone Star Republic, speaking of Texas, which seceded from Mexico in 1836, since Mexico in the 1820s, under leadership of a president of African descent, Vicente Guerrero, had moved to abolish slavery. And just like the United States of America was formed in rebellion against growing abolitionism in London, as reflected in 1772 in Somerset's case, by the way, also reflected in the film Belle, starring Gugu Mbatha Raw. But likewise, the Texians, as they were called, led by Stephen F. Austin and Sam Houston, who have now bequeathed their names to two of the major metropolises in what is now Texas, revolted and seceded from Mexico because of abolitionism. And then after 1836, you had these Texians who were trying to elbow the United States out of the lush slave markets of Cuba and Brazil, but were not able to withstand the pressure exerted upon them by heroic abolitionist Haiti, which was able to win over abolitionist London, and Texas felt that they were about to be overrun as an independent state, so therefore they joined the Union in 1845, becoming, until the ascension of Alaska in 1959, the biggest state territorially within the Union. So this is part of a larger project to rewrite a more accurate and to produce a more accurate history of the United States of America, because I dare say we'll find it difficult to dig ourselves out of the hole in which we find ourselves until we have an accurate estimation of how we got here.
And you explore in this book how the invention of whiteness has its roots not just as a New World phenomenon, but in Europe and in the slave trade.
Well, the slave trade is very interesting. One of the points I make in this book is that one of the problems that the Western Europeans had as they were sailing southward from Bristol and Liverpool and the French port to West Africa, to enslaved Africans, is that they could find themselves enslaved by the Turks, who were then ruling a good deal of North Africa, and then sold into slavery in the Ottoman Turkish slave markets. Therefore, another turning point in terms of explaining why you have so many people of African descent in North America speaking a language developed in Northwest Europe comes in 1683, when the Ottoman Turks or turned back at the gates of Vienna on their westward march, which in some ways is greeted with delirious ecstasy in Western Europe, because with the setback to the Ottoman Turks, they recognized they could more easily sail southward to enslave Africans. I should also say that the enslavement of Europeans, including Euro-Americans, continues, but not to the same degree. I mean, for example, I'm sure you're familiar with the Marine hymn from the halls of Zuma to the shores of Tripoli, and the story in the early 19th century about President Thomas Jefferson seeking to avoid paying ransom to rescue Euro-Americans who had been captured and enslaved in North Africa. But that particular vignette should also lead to a larger truth that I would like to impart, particularly to strugglers in Native America and Black America, which is that in terms of trying to dig ourselves out of the hole in which we find ourselves, we would serve our cause greatly by paying attention to the larger, wider global context. Because if you don't understand the larger, wider global context, you can't understand how we got into this hole in the first place. And so just focusing in a micro sense on what's happening on the block or what's happening in Washington really is not going to do the job. You really have to take a macro point of view. You really have to look with a wide lens at what's happening globally.
You position the Haitian and the Russian revolutions as two of the most important social upheavals of the last couple of centuries. Most of Western scholars, of course, would not agree with that and would be insulted if you did not include the events of 1776.
Well, I understand these, quote, Western, unquote, scholars, because, as noted, 1776 did lead to the liberation and liberty of countless numbers of Europeans. And the fact that they're unable to understand the profundity of the Haitian Revolution 1791 to 1804, the Russian Revolution 1917, really only exposes the naked white supremacy and racism that even has a left-wing form, I'm afraid, as suggested by the maunderings of some of these writers who rather inaccurately and awkwardly consider themselves to be radical. What I mean is that the Haitian Revolution led to a general crisis of the entire system, including in North America, that could only be resolved with its collapse. That is to say, with the Haitian Revolution, London realized the jig was up, knowing that the Haitian Revolution in the first place, as you know, had Jamaican participation. Jamaica was the cash cow for London. And rather than run the risk of losing that investment, not to mention their lives, London moved to abolish the slave trade in 1807 and slavery itself in 1833. The Yankees, who, of course, had a project that was premised and based upon the slave trade and slavery, dug in their heels, which forced a mighty civil war leading to the slaughter of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and then, of course, a war that could not have been won without the participation of tens of thousands of black soldiers. And then, of course, we were to be repaid afterwards by being deported en masse, which we were able to thwart and foil. The Russian Revolution, 1917, not only helped to shift the discourse away from race to class, but for reasons that include destabilizing its antagonists, the colonial powers of Western Europe, not to mention solidarity with the oppressed, not least in Africa and the Caribbean, you can't begin to understand liberation and the decolonization of Africa without understanding aid from Moscow. I'm writing a big book now that will probably be published in Zimbabwe next year on U.S. imperialism and anti-communism and the liberation of Southern Africa. And there's no doubt that the liberation forces in Southern Africa would not have been as successful if they had not been armed by Moscow, just like the Cuban troops who did the heavy lifting in terms of the defeat of the apartheid military on the battlefields of Southern Angola and Northern Namibia were armed by Moscow. And just like what helped to convince the apartheid authorities in Pretoria to negotiate with sweet reason was the Damocletian sword hanging over their head in the form of a threatened Cuban invasion, not only of Namibia, but also of what was then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, but also marching to Pretoria itself and forcibly ejecting these racists from office. That's what helped to induce sweet reason and compromise on their part. And likewise, it's no accident, as F.W. de Klerk, the last apartheid ruler of South Africa, says in his speech before Parliament on February 2nd, 1990, the reason he had decided to free Nelson Mandela and unban the ANC, the African National Congress, was precisely because weeks earlier the Berlin Wall had collapsed, and he sensed that the major bulwark of support for the liberation forces had just been weakened mightily, and that it's best to negotiate with a weakened opponent rather than a strengthened opponent. So once again, in trying to understand the black condition, not understanding the macro context and looking at it through a wide lens obviously is going to lead you into a dead end and a blind alley. But I understand why people don't do it, because they recognize that if they do go down that road, they may get a beat down from these white supremacists, which I'm afraid to say is probably the case.
That was scholar and author Gerald Horn speaking from Houston.